to introduce our speaker for this evening. Let's welcome Carlo L. from Marin County.
Good evening. My name is Carlo. I'm an alcoholic. I have a sobriety date. It's June 22nd, 2008. And man, that one's non-negotiable. I had a few sobriety dates before that, but I traded them in. You know, I was willing to negotiate for them. And this time around, I've just done what was needed to do, you know, to maintain my sobriety on a daily basis, you know, to keep that sobriety date. I have a home group. It's Marin Services for Men. It's a big sober house up in Central Marin, San Rafael. 21 beds. Lots of guys coming from prison. Lots of guys coming off the streets. Lots of guys coming from a divorce. Lots of guys coming out of the psych ward. And it's been a great place for me to go on Friday night and, you know, find some people to help, you know, find some people to talk to. And, you know, bottom line, just find some guys to get to know, you know, and see if they want to go to any outside meetings. I'd like to re-welcome the newcomers real quick. Anyone feeling new or returning to our way of life? You know, it takes a lot of courage to walk into an AA meeting. I mean, I had to be driven to my first AA meeting, and you know, just a big warm welcome. You know, I hope we can get to know each other better, and you know, I hope you found what I found in this fellowship. You know, which is a way of life that is just intensely satisfying. You know, just intensely satisfying. And happy birthday, everyone. All the ladies and gentlemen with birthdays, it's good to get those. Good to get those anniversaries. You know, I used to get real nervous in front of my anniversaries and stuff. Like, you know, I'd have drinking dreams and stuff. You know, around a year and 2 years and stuff. I wake up, I say, "Oh God, I messed it up." You know, and this and that. And it was just a dream. You know, but all that has since passed. You know, and I was kind of reflecting on, you know, my last anniversary and what that meant to me. And I'll talk about that more towards the end. You know, with the what it's like today. But what I'm going to do for you guys tonight is just be real relaxed and honest and just tell you a little bit about my drinking, you know, what it was like, and then what happened, how I got into contact with Alcoholics Anonymous and worked my steps, and then a little snapshot of what it's like today and some fun little stories along the way. So sit back and, yeah, we're going to get to know each other. I was born in San Francisco in 1983. And a few days later, my mom and dad took me home to San Rafael, and I've been there ever since. You know, it's been a great place for me. It's a nice sunny place, nice, a lot of fresh air in Marin County. And my childhood was pretty good. My dad was an alcoholic. Things went pretty south about the time I was 10. He turned real late in life, you know, really fell into the bottle when I was about, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11. And he was asked to leave our house by the time I was 12, and that was very hard. I remember that was one of the first events in my life where my parents divorced, and it just crushed me. I was the firstborn of three boys. I have two younger brothers, and I thought it was my fault. I thought it must be my fault. How could it be anyone else's fault? It's about me. You know, I must have done something wrong. You know, I have to go to this private school because I bite people, and you know, I have all this stuff. And man, I was just a nervous little kid. You know, I was really concerned with what you thought about me. I was really concerned with if you were pleased with me. I was really concerned with where my desk was in the class and what the girls were saying and why I was too scared to talk to the girls and what the teachers thought. And I just tried to make everyone happy. And what ended up happening was I had this spring that was just tightening, you know, just tightening inside me. You know, lots of anxiety. You know, I remember being very worried and just feeling like something was wrong, something was amiss. You know, something wasn't right. And, you know, I remember my first drink. The neighborhood bully asked me if I wanted to go camping. So I said, yeah, let's go camping. And we went out to Bodega Bay, which is up on the Sonoma County coast. And I drove out there with his friends. And, you know, it was him and his older brother. They were, like, really old. They were, like, 18 and 19. And, you know, we got out there. And they started pulling out 12-pack after 12-pack of Miller Lite beer, you know, and they asked me if I wanted one. And I said, yeah, sure, I want one. You know, I was trying to play it off and like I was cool or something. And I remember getting the first one down. Honestly, first one not so memorable. I was still very concerned with what people thought. I was still very concerned with what was going to happen that night and what they, you know, what they thought about me and where I fit into this equation. And then I had my second beer. That one I remember. You know, I remember getting that second beer to my lips and just feeling the primary effects of alcohol, just feeling that sense of ease and comfort, that kind of warmth just kind of wash over me. And I remember it felt like I stood up straight for the first time. You know, I remember just standing up, and my eyes came from this nervously to the sand to all their eyes. And I was like looking them in the eyes. And, you know, I remember it just, I was watching the sunset out of Bodega Bay, and these older guys wanted to hang out with me, and suddenly I could talk, you know, and they were laughing. And I understood immediately why they drank. I understood immediately why my dad drank. I understood immediately why adults drank, you know. It was this amazing release that happened. That spring just let off, you know, just completely let off. And they let me have as many of those beers as I wanted that night. I think I had about 6 Miller Lights, and I got really drunk, really, really drunk. I remember looking down, and my knees were wobbling underneath me, and, you know, they were laughing. I thought they were laughing with me. They made a fire. You weren't supposed to make a fire out there. They had, like, firecrackers. I was like, this is the best day ever, you know. And next thing I remember, I woke up, it was about 6 a.m., and I was freezing cold. I had wet myself, and I had not made it into a tent. I blacked out. I'm a blackout drinker. I just drink until I don't know what's happening, or I don't have control of myself, or I just wake up the next day. That usually happens. The consequences for me started almost immediately. The next year I came home from one of these keg parties at high school and punched my mom in a blackout and got kicked out of the house. Had to go live with my dad for a year, you know, got taken back for senior year, barely graduated high school, you know, all the time drinking more and more, would much rather drink than go to high school, blacking out, you know, just consequences, barely graduated high school, like state minimum 220 credits, like D minus average. You know, when I got out of high school, I went to junior college, thought that'd be a good option. And, you know, in college, some days you don't even have class, you know? So what I found was I was drinking more. You know, this Russian kid I knew ripped my ID apart, my driver's license, and he put a little 79 where the 83 was. So I went from 18 to 22 overnight, and I could buy beer. I could buy beer whenever I wanted. And I learned all the little places, Dandy's and United and Colonial, where I could get beer and they wouldn't touch my ID or try and scan it or anything. And I noticed myself becoming a daily drinker almost overnight. Drinking in the morning, drinking in the afternoons, you know, drinking after school, drinking before school, just a lot of drinking. And, you know, I just chalked it up to an expense. You know, I just thought this is the way it's going to be. This is who I am, and this is what I need to feel good. I got into a pretty bad car accident the next year when I was 19. You know, my friends and I we didn't even know who was the drunkest. So I think we gave some guy who we thought was the least drunk the keys, and he rolled us off a cliff, and we went down like end over end like 12 times. It was a mess. I broke my back. I broke all my ribs. I punctured my lung. You know, my right lung completely collapsed. You know, I broke my wrist, chipped my teeth, severe, severe concussion. You know, they didn't know if I was going to be able to walk again and stuff. I had to be airlifted from Marin County over to Walnut Creek, over to John Muir. And I remember waking up with my dad, like, crying by my bedside, you know, and just not knowing where I was, what I said or did, you know, again. And it was tough. Eventually, I started walking again. They had this huge cast, this big torso immobilization spinal orienter, a TISO cast. It looked like a big giant clam that they would clamp on me to let my vertebrae and my ribs all heal properly. And after a month at John Muir, a month at Kaiser, and 2 months home bed rest, I got loose and went over to my buddy Mark Hendershot's house, and someone tossed me a beer, and I drank it. And I drank a bunch that night. And I didn't black out that night, but I got really, really drunk. And I just was not a very good dot connector back in the days. You know, I just couldn't connect these consequences with my drinking. It progressed, and a couple years later, I really pretty much bottomed out. I was 20 years old. I'd been a daily drinker for a couple years at that point. And I remember waking up one Sunday morning at about 7 o'clock, 7:30, the sun was coming up, and I remember there was about a half bottle of some Smirnoff 100 proof vodka in the corner, and these things from my childhood were just torturing me. You know, these things where I just failed at everything in my life I had attempted up until this point were just torturing me. These relationships that I had that were just all in turmoil were just torturing me. This, like, feelings of inadequacy were just torturing me. And I just remember thinking, like, you know, I hate my life and I want to die. You know, I don't want to be here anymore. And then I remember just tilting that 100 proof vodka back at about 7:30 in the morning and finishing it off, making my way downtown. This is where it gets hazy. And I think I'm sure I went to a bar and I woke up. I woke up in a big white room and my hand was throbbing. And I looked down, there was like this splint that was like duct taped onto my hand and it was just throbbing, you know. And I reached to touch it with my other hand and it was clink, clink, handcuffed to a gurney. And I just remember thinking, like, what did you do now? You know, what have you done? And that feeling of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that the book talks about is like, I was right there. You know, again, I didn't know what I'd gone and said or did or done. I didn't know why my hand hurt. I didn't know where I was. So I start hollering and the nurse comes in to find me, you know, standing on side this gurney, you know, like, hey, can I get out of here or something? And she let me know that the sheriff's department dropped me off and I'd been in an altercation and broke my hand, and that I was going to be there for 3 days for threatening to hurt myself. And I said, okay. You know, I got out of there. My mom said, you're out. You're done. You can't live here anymore. And the judge was very nice. I went and started sleeping on a friend's in a garage on Lincoln and Sandrafel. The judge said, normally we give out 180 days in county jail for something like this, but the person's not going to press charges. Do you think you have a problem with alcohol? And I said, yeah, I do. She said, do you think you're an alcoholic? I said, yeah, I do. And she said, would you like to go to treatment? And I said, yeah, that sounds great. She said, well, I'm going to send you to Kaiser Chemical Dependency Recovery Program. It's a 28-day program. And I'm sitting there thinking, like, 28 days versus 180 days? I said, all right, sign me up. You know, that sounds great. And I went out there. It was out in Vallejo. You know, and what I would do, it's 8 hours a day. It's intensive outpatient. And the first day I went there, and all these guys and gals are like gathered around and stuff, and you know, we all sit down, everybody's smoking cigarettes and stuff, and a guy introduces himself as an alcoholic, and a lady introduces herself as an addict, and another lady introduces herself as an alcoholic, and I can like see it's coming around to me, you know, and I'm like, my name's Carlo, I'm an alcoholic, I guess, you know. And before it was always like a joke, you know, it was like, yeah, I want another one, I'm an alcoholic, you know, or yeah, I'll drink it out of an ashtray, I'm an alcoholic, you know. It was always like a joke or whatever. This was not a joke, you know. This, I was in there with a bunch of like people. One guy cleaned porta potties, another lady was a teacher, you know, another guy was a teacher, a lot of teachers in there, you know. It was very strange. But I learned a lot about alcoholism. I learned that I didn't have a choice whether I was going to drink or not. It was fascinating stuff that was kind of dawning on me. And I just learned that there were a lot of other people having a lot of the same problems as me, you know. And what they did was they gave me a court card. They said, we want you to go to 30 AA meetings to supplement this intensive outpatient program. So I said, okay. I was staying on Lincoln, which is right by our Alano Club there in San Rafael. It's like 3 blocks from Brookdale to the Alano Club. So every day I'd get off intensive outpatient, I'd go to the Alano Club, and I would just sit in the back. You know, we used to have these banners with the 12 traditions and the 12 steps, the big red and white banners, and I would just space out and just stare at those 12 steps. You know, I would not listen to the speaker. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I would just stare, and I understood the first step so perfectly. Powerless over alcohol. Life's unmanageable. I knew those two propositions to be true for years, you know. And then the other 11 steps, 2 through 12, it turned into like Cantonese or something. They were talking about like God and morals and meditation. And I was like, they lost me. And, you know, I understand now that's because the first step has to deal with the problem, this problem identification. And all I knew was the problem. All I was living was the problem. The way I was behaving was the problem. You know, the spiritual malady within me was the problem. I had no solution. So that's why those steps didn't make sense to me, you know. yeah, I was the last guy in the meeting. I was the first guy out. I didn't bother getting a sponsor. I didn't bother getting any phone numbers. I didn't talk to anyone. I didn't take a commitment. And I thought that was close. You know, I'd gotten my purple cast off by then. I'd gotten a haircut. My job took me back. And I thought I'd better not drink. You know, I better put the plug in the jug. And I didn't drink. And I proceeded to work out and get things good with my girlfriend again and get my truck running real good. And I got a hot rod. They said, you need a project. So I got a project, you know, and did all this other stuff, you know, got into great physical shape and started eating right and whoop-de-whoop, you know, started doing all this stuff. And boy, I made it a couple years, you know, but me just not drinking, man, did it turn gray. You know, I've been dating this girl forever. This truck, I've been driving this truck forever. You know, this living situation, I mean, I'm living in a garage, come on. You know, this job, they're failing to recognize my truly exceptional abilities. You know, it's just, this is just all kind of, the gray was just kind of creeping in. And what started happening was the same things that were torturing me when I was drinking the vodka up in my mom's house started to come back and started to torture me again. You know, and just the things that had happened with my family getting fractured and the divorce and just the pain of all these past failings and fears of the future and stuff, this stuff was coming back in spades. You know, it was progressing. And I was irritable. None of the superintendents wanted me on their job site. You know, my girlfriend could barely stand me. I just have these reactions where people would say something, you know, very mild, and I would just bite their head off. You know, I was discontent. The gray was seeping in, and I was real restless. So one night I was driving around. You know, I didn't want to be in the garage, so I drove my truck around. And I remember I landed at Bret Hart Market, you know, and I remember walking up and down the aisles. I didn't know what I was looking for, but I was looking. And I remember throwing a six-pack of my favorite beer on the table, you know, and my favorite beer, Boone Amber Ale. And I remember drinking one on the way home. And I remember thinking, it can't get any worse, you know. And I had both things that the book talks about. You know, I had full knowledge of my condition as an alcoholic, and I had an extended period of, like, sobriety, you know, an extended clean period. Neither one of those things offered me any protection against the first drink, and neither one of those things offered me the ability to drink normally. You know, after that six-pack, the next night was a 12-pack, the next night was an 18-pack. After that, the weekend hit, then there was vodka and all the pills and powder came back into play, and I was off and running, you know. And it wasn't, like, nice and fun like when I was a teenager, you know. I went down much quicker, much harder. And New Year's Eve 2007 rolled around, and boy, I landed myself in bed for days. I don't know how many days it was. I think it was about 2 or 3 days. But I couldn't move. I couldn't get out of bed. I'd put so much stuff in my body, I had literally poisoned myself. I had this orange Home Depot bucket by my bed that I was, like, sick in. It was really bad. And I think my friend Matt finally broke me out of there and took me to the YMCA and just, like, put me in the sauna to, like, try and sweat some of that stuff out, you know. And I thought, this is getting bad again. I had better not drink. So I put the plug in the jug, and I don't even know if I made it a week. And then on Valentine's Day, I was going to get sober for my girlfriend, and I thought I'd better not drink, and I don't think I made it a week. And then I was going to get my car in the Hot Rod Show in May Madness, you know, and I put the plug in the jug, and I don't think I made it a week, you know. And it was at that time where I was just coming to my wit's end, you know. I was... The ceiling in the garage was a little low. It was like 7 feet, you know, but I'd be sitting there at night, you know, sweating, and the stuff was wearing off, and the booze was wearing off, and that ceiling was coming down, man. It was coming down real close. Felt like it was about 18 inches from my face, and my mental health was just deteriorating. You know, my spiritual condition was bankrupt, and I was losing my mind. And this kid who was staying up above me, you know, God works in mysterious ways. Duffy's is like a family institution for them. You know, there's a rehab up north in, like, Lake County or something, way up there. And every one of the family members had been to Duffy's at one point. You know, it was like their college or something, you know. And it was his turn to go to Duffy's because I was partying with him. And he came back and he said, yeah, you know, I'm not going to be doing the stuff we were doing. I'm not even going to be drinking or smoking weed. And I said, all right, Bobby, that seems excessive, but okay, you know. And he was going to meetings. And I knew he was going to meetings because I'd be coming in with my beer and my stuff. And he'd be running out, jumping in a convertible with another guy and two girls going to a meeting. And I was just like, ugh, you know. And so one night it was like, well, I could go down the Golden Gate Bridge and just get it over with. Or, you know, I could call Bobby. You know, I just had this idea in my head. I don't know where it came from. You know, it must have been my higher power. It was just call Bobby, call Bobby, call Bobby. I just couldn't get it out of my head, you know. And so I called him and I was crying, you know, and I said, Bobby, I don't know how it got this bad. You know, I don't know what to do. I don't think I can go on. You know, he said, oh, let's go to the young people's meeting. Da da da. In Terre Lynde, I'll pick you up tomorrow. Da, da, da. And I said, okay. You know, I didn't remember much of meetings except for just sitting there and spacing out. But sure enough, he picked me up, and he took me there. And man, that spring was just about as tight as you could get it. You know, the girls were so pretty, and everybody already knew each other, and they were smoking cigarettes and drinking rock stars and like laughing, and they all knew like how to be sober. And I was just like paralyzed. I remember I just sat in the back of this meeting and just writhed through the whole thing. And at the end of it, this guy came up and said, like, you need a sponsor. I'm your sponsor, you know. And he wrote down his number on a meeting schedule. And this guy was real nice. His name was Andy, but he wanted me to do all this stuff. He wanted me to, like, call him every day, call three other alcoholics every day, underline the word hopeless in the first few chapters of the book, you know, like, get a commitment. It was, like, on and on and on. This guy wanted me to do all this stuff. And after about 2 or 3 weeks of, like, kind of shucking and jiving with him, I remember telling him, like, you know, Andy, you're a nice guy, and I appreciate what you're trying to do for me, but I haven't read a book since I was 16, since I read Catcher in the Rye, and I'm not reading that book either, but thank you. And ran into my dealer at the gas station the next day, and we went to the ATM, and I had no effective mental defense against the first drink. You know, I was just off and running. I was just without any protection at all. And so I was out for a few weeks, and at the end of that, same thing, call Bobby, you know. It's like I heard this lady at the couch meeting say a couple years ago, this has always stuck with me. She said she thought that God enters us through our wounds, you know, and that was like my experience, you know. It was just like when I was all the way at the end, you know, when like alcohol had finally become like the great persuader, like he was right there, you know. I called Bobby. He's like, oh, yeah, let's go to the men's meeting, you know, Monday night, men's tag. And I was like, all right, here we go, you know. And so I go down there. There's like 100 dudes in this church, just dude sweat, just wall to wall, you know. And it's like the same guys that I was seeing a month ago or whatever. They all got like wedding rings, and they're eating the salami, and they got car insurance and stuff, you know. And it's just like they're all laughing. And I remember I just walked all the way to the back and just sat in the back. And I remember just sitting with my hand over my face like this, because I just didn't even want to look at you. I didn't want you to look at me. You know, I was just in crisis. And couldn't tell you what happened in that meeting. But I remember when we were saying the Lord's Prayer at the end, I was holding hands with everyone. And I was seeing this guy across the room that claimed to have 22 years. And you hadn't kicked him out yet. And I went up to him right after. And I said, are you accepting sponsees? And he said, yeah. And I said, will you accept me? And he said, yeah, sure. And I said, yes. And he said, well, what'd you do this morning? And I said, well, I made my lunch and I went to work. And he said, no, did you make your bed and say your prayers? I said, no. He said, why not? I said, Joe, I've never done either of those things before in my life. And he said, well, tomorrow you're going to start. You know what a made bed looks like, and we're going to start you off with an easy one. God, thanks for keeping me sober yesterday. God, please keep me sober today. Okay, here we go. So I got three pillows, put them at the top of the bed, make that sucker up. It's like 6:30 in the morning, you know, and I'm standing on side this bed, and this guy from AA with 22 years, who I barely know, wants me to pray to God, you know. And the only time I've been in a church like this, I think I went to a girl's quince when I was 15. And the only thing I know about spirituality or religion or whatever this is that, you know, you're like Ned Flanders, or, you know, you're like Mel Gibson and We Were Soldiers, and you have a pretty little wife and like kids of just getting smaller size, you know, and you all pray on side of the bed. Like I really didn't know anything. And I thought, this is weird. I can't do this. I've never done this before. I don't know how to do this. What am I going to have to do next? Are they going to want my money? Do they want me to cut my hair? Do I have to do this every day? Do I have to go to AA every day? I was just like on and on and on, you know? And then one voice just came over the rest, just real calm, just like I'm talking to you right now. And it was my voice, you know? And I just heard myself very simply say, Carlo, we have to do this. You've tried everything else and you're getting worse. So I'm down there. I don't really know how to hold my hands, you know? Do I hold them like this? Do I like say the prayer? Do I just mouth it or do I just think it, you know? It's like, do I look up? Is this where he is, you know? And I think I muttered out, God, thanks for keeping me sober yesterday. God, please keep me sober today. And then I looked around. Nothing happened. I made my lunch and I went to work, you know? But these little pieces of willingness, these like little pieces of open-mindedness, that is all I had in the beginning, little pieces. That was sufficient for me to make a beginning in this program. That was sufficient for me to like get going and make an approach to the steps. He wanted to meet up once a week, so we met up before the Pacific Group on Tuesday nights, and we read for an hour, and he'd listen to me talk about all these pressing problems and what a smoldering crater my life was and how she was gone and I was $20,000 in debt and I'm sleeping on a sleeping bag on the floor at my mom's house and my job is on the ropes. And after about 5 minutes of that, he'd say, okay, what page are we on? You know, and he wanted to read this book again. It's like, what is it with this book? You know, I remember telling him, I said, Joe, I have real problems, you know, and you got a book here? A book is going to fix me, you know? I was just flabbergasted that it came down to a book, you know? And sure enough, we started reading it. Now, I was very hazy in early sobriety. I was coming off a pretty heavy regimen of pills and booze, you know? So I didn't really understand much of this stuff, but I understood when we got to the first step and he asked me to go home and concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. I could grasp that assignment. So I sat on the edge of my made bed and I just got it on a gut level. You know, that this is who I am, this is how I'm built, and this is the problem, you know. The second and third step, I did not understand at all, you know. He asked me, we got to that point, he said, well, do you now believe in a power greater than yourself? And I said, Joe, I don't know. You know, and he said, like, well, will you just be willing to believe? You know, and for some reason, like just a little bit of open-mindedness was there that I said, okay, I'll do it. I'll try it. You know, I'll just try it. You know, and just a little bit of light, man, just a little bit of open-mindedness goes a long way. You know, we got to that third step prayer, which I think he gave me like kind of a deceptively simple assignment for the third step. It was like, memorize the third step prayer. You know, and so I had one of those little gold cards. I still got one out there in my wallet, you know, with the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer and the St. Francis prayer. And I remember thinking to myself, like, I'm going to say this third step prayer in the morning until something happens. Something's going to happen. You know, I'm going to see maybe not a burning bush, but I'm going to see something, you know. And what happened was I memorized the third step prayer. And what happened was I stayed sober. And I kept reading with him. I kept going to meetings. I got a couple greeter commitments, you know, which was just horrible. You have to stand out in front of the meeting. And, like, I was like, Joe, I'm so bad with names. I feel retarded. He said, Carlo, it is not impolite for you to ask someone to remind you of their name, you know. And I started learning the names, you know. And I had this at, like, two meetings and stuff. And I just got in the fellowship, you know. It was exactly what I needed at that time. And, you know, when it came time to say the third step prayer, we were meeting before our meeting, and we were meeting at Starbucks, and it was like rush hour. It's like 6:30 on like a Monday night. There's ladies flying in and out of there. There's guys flying in and out of there. And he said, okay, let's say it. And he stands up, and I stand up. Then he gets down on his knees, and I thought, he's going to do this right here, you know. And I thought in my little like 90-day reptile brain, it's gonna look a lot weirder if I'm standing on the side of this guy praying, so I had better just get down there. So I hopped down there, he started up, I chimed in, and we did the thing, you know, and I was just willing to do that, you know. I was buying what he was selling, you know, and I was willing to do that. With the four step, I was like so relieved that it got back to like an actual assignment that my brain could like grasp. You know, I knew who I was resentful at. I knew what I was afraid of, and I knew who I'd had sexual contact with. I started writing immediately. I wrote out all these lists of just chronologically, you know, all these schoolmates that I'd gotten in fights with, all these teachers I hated, all these police that have beat me up, you know, all my family, my friends, you know, just wrestling coaches, just anyone I had had significant contact with in my life. I had some kind of resentment and connection with them, you know, and all these fears that just had never happened, you know, and about, you know, 30 women that I had treated very poorly, you know, 30 people that I had really, really harmed, you know. And I said, I think I'm done. Nothing else is coming out. And he said, okay, would you like to set a date for a fifth step? And I said, all right. You know, I learned about a week before I did a fifth step that you're going to go over all this fourth step stuff, which was much to my astonishment. And he said, okay, well, my roommate won't be home. And went over there. His roommate's car was not there. I went upstairs. He said, come on in. You know, and there was a box of tissues and a pizza on the table. And I said, okay, let's do it. And we said the third step prayer again. That's the kind of sponsor I had. And, you know, I cracked open my step work binder, and there was my dad's name, you know, Charles Thomas Lombardi, you know, with about a dozen resentments right next to it, you know, just scratched into the page. And, you know, I just lost it, you know. I just put my head down in my hands, and that stuff was just, it was just killing me. It was just killing me from the inside. It was just driving and dominating me, just acute and troublesome on a daily basis, an hourly basis, minute to minute. You know, that inventory was like who I was, and I just had this body full of like just sick emotions just all day, every day. And when the waterworks stopped, I used some of the tissue, and I ate some of the pizza, and then we started talking about it. And we started talking about all of it. We had a long conversation. And, you know, I had always given, like, somebody a little bit of the story, or the police a little bit of the story, you know, or my football coach a little bit of the story, and AA just wanted the whole story, just the whole story. And we went over the whole story, you know? And what I learned going over that with him is he said, you know, these things, a lot of them are actually really common for young men. You know, are these things are really actually common for alcoholics? Or, oh, that one happened to me too. I did that. And just hearing him say those things, you know, helped clear away all this, like, morbidity and stuff that I was living with. And he had a lot of the same experiences, and he let fly a few of his things that topped all my stuff, you know? So I was like, all right. And I didn't really feel like, I love the fifth step promises out of the book. You know, we begin to feel the nearness of our Creator and all that stuff. I love the fifth step promises. But I remember I went to the YMCA and worked out. But when I told people in AA that I did a fifth step, they said, welcome. You know, welcome to AA. You're now like a card-carrying member, you know. And it was good. How much? Okay, cool. You know, and it was just good. I felt like I really got back on track and just turned a corner, you know, and it was good. It set me up for the rest of the house cleaning steps. 6 and 7, which are just, like, so paramount today, like dealing with character defects and stuff, just so paramount at 8 years of sobriety, which I really kind of overlooked the first time through. 8 and 9, I remember, you know, I said, I'm willing to do all these amends and stuff, and then after about 2 weeks, my sponsor said, would you like a ride to one of your amends, you know, after I hadn't done any of them. He said, just pick one. You know, just pick one. And I remember we went to Orchard Supply and Hardware in San Rafael, and we said a prayer, the third step, you know, and I went in there, and the only guy I could find was this guy who had helped me find all these, like, parts for my hot rod and stuff, who had, like, helped me out, like, a bunch of times. And there was, like, no one else working. I was like, God, I got to go to this guy, you know, and he was the assistant manager, and he took me in the back room, and he said, well, we don't really have any recourse for this sort of thing. And he said, Carlo, I want you to understand, we do want you as a customer, but if you steal again, I'm going to call the police, you know? And that just really, like, woke me up to, like, how my behavior, like, you know, just rippled through the world and stuff. And I made a lot of amends. I had a lot of financial amends. I had some amends to women, amends to my family. I had a lot of amends, you know, but it was good. You know, the freedom that comes from that process is just unparalleled. You know, I can just hold my shoulders back and hold my head up anywhere now, you know, it's because it's like I cleaned up the mess and I don't make hardly any new messes, you know. And 10, 11, and 12 is like kind of where I exist today. You know, the inventorying process has just really helped me map out, you know, areas where I'm thriving, but also areas where I need to improve and areas where I need to work on stuff. And, you know, I still got a few little vices. You know, I still got a few little character defects. You know, I still got a few things that absolutely need attention. And the conundrum is even with good command and application of the steps and spiritual principles and all this stuff, I'm still not equipped to, you know, deal with a character defect. You know, I'm still not equipped to, like, disarm a character defect. You know, I have to have help. I have to have help with a higher power. And the 11th step is just great. Can't say enough about it. You know, at about like 4 years of sobriety, I started going to this meditation meeting at the Strawberry Rec Center, and it just really opened up the floodgates. I remember I was just a prayer mechanic before then. You know, I knew when to pray, how to word the prayer, you know, this and that. And my sponsor said, "Carlo, it's not an 11 and a half step program. Why don't you come to this meditation meeting with me?" And I said, "All right." And meditation has just been invaluable. You know, I remember I'd been going to that meeting for about 3 or 4 months. And I remember this, you know, just seeing my thoughts and just becoming aware of it and just sitting still for a while. And I remember thinking, they're just thoughts. They're just words. And then this customer in Mill Valley called my work sloppy one day. And I remember having this totally new idea and just thinking, it's just words. And I didn't tell him what I thought. I didn't give him some large chunks of truth about himself. I didn't prepare to pull my tools off the job and say I'm never working here again. I said, I'll fix it tomorrow. You know, it's just totally, totally new ideas, totally new behavior on my end. And meditation has really made that possible and has really just helped me to just kind of even things out, you know. And the 12th step is like, man, the 12th step is like our super step. You know, there's really like 2 or 3 steps in there. It is just super amped up. You know, having had a spiritual awakening, I mean, this is the greatest promise that the book makes, you know, is that I can recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body by taking 12 steps. You know, it's just unreal, you know, and it's something that doesn't even fit into English. You know, it's like we share from the floor and we come up front and share and stuff, but it's hard to really describe what's happened to me over the past few years. You know, it's just been a total change, you know, from someone who is spiritually bankrupt to someone who's operating off spiritual principles, you know, and has belief, reliance, and dependence on a higher power. And it's just been amazing, you know. And then can't say enough for sponsorship. I mean, one of the biggest gifts I got was a few years ago, I got a few guys all in quick succession who came to me with some time, you know, not new guys, you know, from MSM or from the Stag or from a meeting or something, but guys that came with me to me from, you know, and had like some months, you know, or had some years and said, "Hey, you know, I like what you got, you know, let's work together." And a lot of these guys have like stuck around and stuff. And it's been the first time I've had like kind of a consistent roster. And it's just been so rewarding just to have a relationship like that, just to invest into, you know. And I still try and keep a guy, you know, 1 through 9, keep a guy in the book, you know, I'll even take 2 guys in the book, you know, I'm not that busy right now. But just to have these guys who are consistently calling, and man, it's like they're my brothers, you know, it's like they're my kids, it's like they're my family and stuff. It has just been, just totally changed my perspective, you know. And so quickly, I'll wrap up in a second, you know. But what it's like today, just reflecting on just having really been just able to live this like charmed sobriety. I've had a pretty charmed sobriety, you know. I've had a few times when I was running on self-will and making a string of decisions based on self and stuff. But overall, it's been just an upward trend, you know. But what does this mean? What does this mean going into my 9th year? And I've been like meditating on this in the morning and stuff. And I just want joy, you know. The book says that we're sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. And I just want that joy, you know, because it's like, face it, like when we get out of here, like everyone in here is kind of vibing the same, but you meet people that aren't operating off spiritual principles, you know. And some of my subs are like, this and that, back charge, change order, you know, da, 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 da. And it's just like, where's your joy, you know? Where's your happiness? You know, where did it go? And it's like you just get so grateful so quick about what we have in here, you know. And that's what I want, you know, heading into my 9th year, is I want to be happy, you know. I want to be free, I want to be joyous, you know. And it has a lot to do with me staying relaxed, taking it easy, you know, not struggling, staying out of the way, not trying to control and manage anything because I'm not management material. And it's just been good. It's been really good. You know, every area of my life has been filled to overflowing. You know, it's just all overflowing. And what I try and do on a daily basis is just be on the lookout for somebody who I can help give that back to, just kind of fill their cup up a little bit. And a lot of it is very small stuff. You know, I help my guys to kind of show them, like, hey, you can hold the door for someone. You know, you can smile when you enter a room to put people at ease. You know, you can be polite. You know, you can do all these little things that just make such a difference in the community you're in and in the environment you're in. And it's just all such small stuff, you know, just being decent on the road and, you know, all these little things, you know. So anyways, everything good I have in my life, you know, I got my mom back, I got my brothers back, you know, my girlfriend, my company, all these things I just attribute to the work I've done in Alcoholics Anonymous. That is where it came from, you know. And I love the little fellowship you guys have here. Kevin, thanks for asking me to speak. Cody, thanks for letting me sleep on your floor. And, you know, I've just found such a wonderful little, like, kind of second fellowship down here. You know, you guys are just so tight-knit, and everybody's just vibing the same. And, you know, thank you guys so much for having me tonight.
Thank you, Carl. Let's give him another round of applause. All right, we'd like to thank everyone who has a commitment here. Kevin is our commitment coordinator.